sighting of the moon. For them, Eid likely will begin tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers, Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Arizona is offering Americans who are overseas online voting. Starting on Thursday, voters registered in Arizona but who live overseas will be able to vote online through a unique web-based system. The new system will allow registered voters to apply for early ballots online and then submit their ballots electronically using a document scanner. Previously, Arizona election officials allowed voters to fax in their ballots, but since it's getting harder to find a fax machine at an overseas military installation, voters now have both options. I'm Carl Castle, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
Today's broadcast is made possible by The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta offers a private dining room for parties, meetings, and other events. The Great Impasta, 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Prairie Ridge Farms Incorporated, Allerton; Michael W. Walker Consulting, Urbana; Guido's, Champaign; and Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about the crisis that is now threatening America's financial sector. Talk a little bit about how the government is trying to respond. We have two guests with us here this morning. Both of them are economists at the University of Illinois, Fred Gertz and Ann Villamil. Fred is currently serving as the head of the economics department. He's also associated with the Institute for Government and Public Affairs. Ann is professor of economics, and glad to have both of them here. We'll try to talk a little bit about this bailout plan that's been proposed and was just yesterday defeated by the House. Maybe we'll also try to talk a little bit about what this means for the economy of the Midwest, and maybe specifically for the state of Illinois. And questions from people who are listening are welcome, as always. The number, if you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That is 800-222-9455 at any point here. You want to join the conversation, you're certainly welcome. The thing that we just ask people to try to do is be brief in their comments so we can keep moving along. But anybody's welcome to call. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just as a way of starting out, now for the past couple of weeks, we've been listening to the president, to members of Congress, various commentators talking about just how serious the situation is and using very, very strong terms to describe that. So let me ask you both, and maybe I'll start with Fred, to respond to that. Just how serious a situation is this?
It's very serious, but not catastrophic, but action needs to be taken. Typically, we're talking about marginal things like should the discount rate be raised, or are we worried about a little bit too much inflation or unemployment? So the typical decision in terms of the Federal Reserve and macro policy has to do with these what I would call marginal kind of issues. This is a more structural, fundamental thing where if the system devolves into chaos, these other things are going to be irrelevant. So this is a very, very important. It's underlying stability, making sure the system works. And once that's established, we can go back to the old world of worrying about whether we should or should not raise the discount rate every month or so. So this is very, very serious. It's not necessarily a catastrophe yet, and it can be avoided, but action has to be taken.
Well, that's when the administration started talking about this, when I think it was Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, first said to members of Congress, this is what we think should happen. And he was saying, and we think that you need to act, we the administration think you need to act on this now, within the next day or two, by the end of the week, certainly. And well, we've sort of gone past that deadline. How, I suppose in a sense I'm asking the same question, but maybe another way of asking it would be, well, suppose we do nothing. What's the worst that could happen?
Credit will dry up. I mean, it's a very serious problem. Right now, there's been a loss of confidence in the banking system among banks. So they're not willing to lend to each other. So the various central banks, not just the Fed, but central banks around the world are injecting liquidity into the system and banks are hoarding it. So that's a big problem because as businesses go to banks to get loans, as individuals eventually go to banks to try and get loans, they're not going to be able to get them. So that's very serious. Mm-hmm.
And that is the kind of thing that could that would affect not just, say, big corporations or big businesses that want to borrow big chunks of money. Does that also affect people at the individual level, people who either it's a small business, you want a loan for that, or maybe you just you want to go out and borrow money so that you can buy a house?
Absolutely. It's actually individuals who go to the bank to buy a house, who go to the bank for their small business loan. Very large corporations in more normal times can access the stock market, can access the bond market. So it really is going to show up on Main Street. And I think that has not been appreciated.
And the thing that's driving this, I think, is the memory of the Great Depression. We think now that suddenly the stock market crash in 1929 generated 10 years of misery. But I think most economists now believe that 1929 was a downturn, probably a serious recession, but it was converted from a serious recession into the Great Depression by allowing the monetary system to collapse. The bank runs and failures of banks moved it to a different level, and that's what we're trying to avoid now. So no one was around then, but I think the economists have a fairly uniform view that that something has to be done to stabilize the system. And there's a different world. We're not talking about bailing out Chrysler or Ford or Enron or something of that sort. Those firms fail. They have major consequences to their employers, their stockholders and so on, but they don't reverberate through the whole economy. This is a situation where we're talking about the underlying stability of the financial system. So it's quite a different world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what do you think about the plan that has been proposed by the administration? Do you think that that's the right way to go? Setting aside this very large chunk of money so that essentially at his discretion, the Secretary of the Treasury can go out and buy up these bad loans.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not a perfect plan, but we do need to get a plan done. And I think there are a lot of bad loans out there. We need to get them off the books so that banks can start lending again. So that's part of it. The other part of it is a word that we hear a lot is counterparty risk. I think most people don't understand what that means. So an individual bank knows what's on its balance sheet. It knows how many bad loans it has. But banks are afraid to lend to other banks because they're not sure what's on someone else's balance sheet.
Oh, hold on a second.
Are we off the air?
I think we're back.
I guess we're back. I just thought for a moment there we popped off the air. Okay. I'm sorry. Sorry for folks listening for the eruptions. Sorry for you for the eruption. Pick up the point where you are.
Well, this issue of counterparty risk is very serious. So banks are unwilling to do business with other banks, which is a typical part of their business and the ability to make the financial system work, because they don't know what is on another bank's balance sheet. So if we can get that problem cleaned up, we're going to unclog the system and get banks lending again.
There's a saying from tax policy that I think applies here, and that's the perfect is the enemy of the good. If we waited around for a perfect plan, nothing's going to get done. And in fact, most of the plan is going to be developed after the bill is passed. There has to be all kinds of regulation, rules, and procedures, and those are going to be developed in the Treasury and with the Fed. So the point is to get started here. If we wait around to get it exactly right, there's going to be much more damage than if we pass a bill that's acceptable and then move forward.
Yeah. Well, we have several callers here. I want to get to them in just a minute. Let me ask you maybe one other question at least. I think if we went back just a couple of weeks ago and we went out and we asked people if they could tell us who the Secretary of the Treasury was, I bet a lot of people would say, I don't know. Well, now people know who Henry Paulson is. And not only do they know, but a lot of people seem to have opinions on the quality of his work. Do you think that the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Paulson, has done a good job in dealing with this?
I think he has a political tenure, but economically, in terms of understanding that we had to deal with parts of this problem now, he understood that. The problem is, I think he's not communicated well to the person on the street why it is so urgent to get parts of this done now. I completely agree with what Fred said. A lot of people are offended by, they understand that we need more regulation, more oversight. All of these things are true. But right now, there's an extreme credit crisis. And if we can't get credit flowing again in the economy, businesses are going to fail. the mortgage situation is going to become even worse. So we've got to address that problem now because that's immediate, and take care of these other things which legitimately need to get taken care of later on in a deliberative way. And then we can hold congressional hearings and do all of those things. But there is a crisis right now.
And this is also a very complex issue. I have opinions about a lot of things, and sometimes I think I can do it better than whoever's in charge. But this is one case where I'm happy to be a passenger and allow Bernanke to do the piloting. This is a very, very complex issue, lots of different angles, and this really is the case for some valuable expertise. I think we have that. There's also a kind of policy or guidelines about central banking and the monetary system, and usually the less you have a political involvement, the better it is. One of the reasons why central banks do well is that they're insulated to a certain extent from the day-to-day vicissitudes of politics, and this is maybe a case where eventually that probably should reoccur.
I just want to add one more thing. Something Fred said was important. He talked about the Great Depression, but actually these financial crises happen from time to time in all countries. The last one we had in the United States was not the Great Depression. It was in 1988 after the S&L crisis, and these bailouts are expensive. So the 88 cleanup is estimated by the IMF to have cost 3.7% of GDP, which is non-trivial. That's real money. But again, the last big one we had was not the Great Depression, or not only the Great Depression. It was in Japan. Japan had a banking crisis in the 90s, which went on for 10 years, and the IMF estimates it cost 31% of their GDP.
And they wouldn't realize the problem they had. They tried to sweep it under the rug.
And so that's why this idea of we need to act now is important, because there are parts of this that need to be addressed to keep what could be a 3 or 4% problem in terms of GNP from turning into a 20 or 30% problem.
Just one other thing, I think that some of the criticism of the proposal goes along these lines. It says that it gives an awful lot of power, perhaps too much power, to the Treasury, because essentially it's Treasury that decides who it is that's going to get the pieces and how much of this $700 billion.
Right.
Do you think that that's true?
There's a lot of power, but I think it's necessary. The Treasury now is operating in kind of a vacuum. The Federal Reserve is designed to deal with banks. They've done the banks fairly well, but we have this new kind of world where there's a lot of financial activity that takes place outside the traditional banking system. I think by sort of default, the Treasury is moving into that area. So there may be a better institutional arrangement we could think of eventually, but the Treasury is the place we have to go right now.
Yeah, and when I said I thought Paulson was getting the policy right but had a tin ear on the politics, that's what I meant. I think he has said that if you want to have certain people like Warren Buffett or Michael Bloomberg, you hear these names in the news as being a board of advisors or a board of overseers. I think he has already said that that's fine. The concern is that we can't have congressional committees trying to make, fine-tune this policy right now, because we saw what happened yesterday.
Yeah, big decline in the stock market, obviously, and now it looks like it'll be a couple of days maybe before they at least get back to talking about it. So we don't really even know how long it would take. Even if when they got back to work, there was an agreement, there was a vote, it could be mid next week, end of next week, and that could be pretty serious if we keep seeing those kind of declines.
Mm-hmm. Let me sort of answer a question before it's asked. And the question is, are we bailing out these people who acted irresponsibly and helping people who are undeserving? And the answer is yes. We're doing it. The bailout, the rescue package is not to help the people who acted imprudently. It's not because they're deserving. It's not because they're nice people. It's because it's protecting the overall system, which includes everyone else, people who have retirement accounts, pension funds, things of that sort. So the byproduct is we have to carry out the bailout, which may mean some undeserving people get some benefits. But the more important issue is protecting the whole system.
Right. And I think, I've probably used this word this morning, but we do keep referring to it as a bailout. The legislation is actually referred to as the Financial Stabilization Plan, or the the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act. And that's what it is. As Fred was saying, it's about stabilization, not bailing out a particular person.
And we're not – the people who had – the organizations that have had the problem so far, like Lehman Brothers and AIG, those people have pretty much lost their equity and they're coming away with zero. The stockholders in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac pretty much have lost everything. So we're not protecting the first-line people. We're protecting the people who are dealing with them and dealing with the assets. Then that's the problem we have. If those things don't work, the whole system is going to be destabilized.
Mm-hmm. We have two guests with us here in the studio this morning, both professors of economics here at the University of Illinois, Fred Gertz and Ann Villamil. We're talking about the current U.S. economic crisis. Questions welcome. We have several. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller, Champagne, line one.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at the plan, the Paulson plan, congressional plan that's been put out, and I just think the priorities are wrong. I mean, is purchasing $700 billion of toxic assets the best way to recapitalize the financial system? After all, you know, when there is a systemic banking crisis, you know, you want to recapitalize the banking finance system to avoid an excessive and destructive credit contraction. And I think, you know, purchasing toxic liquid assets, just not the way to go. There's so many other ways to go. You could, you know, government purchase of subordinated debt. You know, there could be government injection of common shares, the Swedish model. But, you know, I think history is littered with corpses of countries that really tried to purchase the toxic assets, Japan being a glaring example. And I wonder if you could just comment on that. I think recapitalizing the banks, bringing down the overnight swap spreads, which is crucial to credit lending. After all, you know, the credit markets are actually frozen. The only people that are lending are central banks and whatever. I wonder if you could just comment on that part of the focus on purchasing the toxic assets in the package rather than recapitalizing the banks and thus restoring confidence. Thank you.
All right.
You know, well, Fred and maybe can follow up, but, you know, you mentioned Sweden. It's an interesting example. You know, going back to the numbers, they had a financial crisis in 1991, it cost them 3.6% of GDP. And you're right, they did it by more capital injection. So, you know, it's certainly something to look at. But, you know, the problem with that is the Treasury. There's already been a lot of concern about Paulson having too much power. So this idea of deciding on a case-by-case basis now, you know, which institutions are we going to save and which are we going to let go. I think some of what was behind his idea of having a reverse auction was the idea was for the banks to come to the Treasury or to come really to an auction and submit bids to get rid of these things. Right? So it's a question of getting these guys to come forward because that's what's happening right now with the financial system. It's frozen. The Fed already is injecting massive liquidity, but the banks are sitting on it because of this counterparty risk. So you've got to get these assets off their balance sheets.
Yeah, we don't have the luxury of doing controlled experiments. I mean, that there may be other ways of doing this. This is one way, and I think that's the way that seems to be easiest to agree on right now. So it's not to say that there's not a better way, but and there's also the some people argue old-time monitors that we should simply let the organizations collapse and see what would happen, and we'll get some discipline that way. But again, I don't want to risk that that outcome. So there are all kinds of things that might work, but I think we have to choose the one that seems to be the easiest to get approved and has a good chance of working.
Right, and your concern about some equity, I think, was also important because that has been somewhat addressed. At least it's on the table in terms of talking about warrants.
All right. Let's then continue. Next, we'll talk with somebody in Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello, and welcome back, Mr. Inge. I hope you had a nice vacation. Interesting topic to come back to. And I like to point out that, you know, I understand that we need to protect the banks and stuff and go on. But really, when it came to the Depression, the only thing that got us out of the Depression is when we finally put money back into our own infrastructure and started building with the WPA, and then even more so during World War II. So wouldn't it be wise for us to send this money to the people to make their mortgages and everything would be better?
Well, Well, I think it's a separate question. The reason why the Depression lasted so long was because the financial system collapsed, so it wouldn't have been as necessary to have the things you talked about. That's a separate issue, whether we need another stimulus package and so on is, I think, open to debate. But this is a more immediate kind of thing, and it's not going to substitute for, you know, money into the system in terms of rebates or public works projects. It's not going to substitute for having a stable kind of system that we can rely on, and that has to be done first.
Yeah, and the Fed and central banks around the world are intervening massively right now.
And we actually, surprisingly enough, the Federal Reserve and other central banks have gotten pretty high marks the last 25 years. Maybe this term will no longer apply, but there's called the period of the Great Moderation starting from about 1980 on. The business cycle has been less severe. We've had longer expansions, shorter contractions, things of that sort. So the monetary authorities have done a pretty good job. This is going to be, the ultimate test of that.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. We'll go on. And next we'll talk with someone in Champaign in line three. Hello.
Yeah. Looking back a little bit, though, you said that they did a good job. It seems to me that they held the interest rate way too low. You know, our economy is based on the housing market. I mean, that was sort of crazy. So there was no good options for people to invest except in the housing, where they were making all kinds of money, and especially, you know, that bait and switch or whatever went on. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, you know, I certainly agree that there are a lot of mistakes that were made. So it was not only were interest rates low in terms of the Fed, but, you know, Bernanke has called this the global savings glut. So you actually really need to look at the world and see that there are some countries that are saving a lot. You know, particularly a number of countries in Asia are saving a lot. They have very high savings rates. In the U.S., we have a very low savings rate. So funds were flowing into the U.S., and yes, they supported this expansion, you know, and that combined with lax regulation got us into the trouble we're in. Now, do we lack good investment opportunities? You know, I certainly think that's not the case. We have an energy crisis. We could do a lot. There are a lot of things that we could be investing in. There's a lot of infrastructure that we could be investing in. You know, but I do agree with you that the housing sector got, and I think the facts bear it out because the prices are falling, got out of balance.
It may be a question of trying too hard to fine tune. After the recession in 2001 and 9/11, I think the Federal Reserve was especially interested in trying to maintain stability, and they maybe went in retrospect. Went too far, but I think they had a bigger goal in those days. So if we had to do over again, it would probably have been better to allow the recession to be a little bit deeper in 2001 and not to stimulate this sort of cycle that's gotten started with the housing. But again, that it was easy to say now. It's not easy to say.
Yeah. Well, this was, in fact, something that was in my mind as well, the fact that we have over the last, I don't know how many years, had these two boom-bust cycles, first with the enthusiasm for high-tech, and that bubble burst, and then people went looking for something to put their money into, and the thing that they put their money into was real estate. And I think that everybody felt for a long time that real estate was hugely overvalued, and that sooner or later that was just not sustainable, and sooner or later that bubble would burst, and it did. Is there anything that you can do to prevent that kind of cycle, or is that just something that's going to that's almost an inevitable thing that you're just going to see happen?
Well, I think the first one, the dot-com and telecommunications and so on, was happened, and it was a mistake in retrospect. But I think that's probably something we would stay out of. But the housing situation actually was fueled by Fed policy, and that's something I think could have been handled much better. So I differentiate between the two. The recession in 2001 was more like a 19th century recession where we had overbuilding and railroads, and people were over enthusiastic, and those things happen, and there are mistakes, but they don't wreck the system. But the current situation has more potential for destabilizing the underlying financial system.
Hmm. We are at a midpoint already. We have two guests, Fred Gertz. He is a professor of economics here at the U of I. He's at the moment serving as the head of the department. He's also associated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And also with us is Anne Villamil, who is, in addition, professor of economics here at the U of I. We're talking about the current crisis. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if, rather than throwing a lot of money in at the top of the system in the financial institutions, it might not be better to put money into the bottom of the system by helping to refinance homes using sound lending principles rather than the kind of lending principles we've seen, using government money. And then when those homes have been refinanced, the money that has been gained from those can go back to pay off the debts to the lenders and the securities, and credit should start to flow again. It might be a slower process, but perhaps slower would be better in this case.
Well, we can do that. The current plan actually doesn't preclude that. So if the Treasury buys up these bad securities, it can set up a program to renegotiate these mortgages. That can happen. You know, the thing is that setting up such a program is going to take some time. And that's this idea of there are certain immediate problems and then some long-term things. So the idea is to get the assets off the books now and then to unwind them over time, perhaps in precisely the way you're discussing. But we need to deal with the problem now because, as you said, this is going to take some time.
Okay, thank you.
I think that this has been one of the criticisms that there are people who really are in desperate need, the people who are likely to lose their homes, and that the government ought to be doing something to try to help at least some of those people and prevent that from happening.
Yeah, the problem is, I mean, it seems harsh, but the individual homeowner is not too big to fail. A big financial company, AIG, is too big to fail. So they're not doing it on the basis of equity. It's not that a big financial firm is more deserving than a homeowner under pressure. But the fact mm-hmm. is, to deal with the stability of the system, they have to look at where the problem is. And the problem is, in a sense, the too big to fail kind of organizations. And I think there's been a learning by doing. I think they actually found out that even though they thought Lehman Brothers wasn't too big to fail, it may have come close to being too big to fail. So they had a lot of problems. But the one that they just tried to impart some discipline into the system, and they let Lehman Brothers go, and it turned out that it was more damaging than they expected.
Right. Next, Champaign County, line 1. Hello.
Hi. A corporation that's too big to fail is probably too big and should be trust busted, I would guess. But there are a lot of threads here, but most recently the idea that there should be a mandate for the process of bailing out the deserving mortgage holder as opposed to the undeserving corporation. The legislation as it was enacted doesn't mandate it. It says that they may. It doesn't say shall. So that would be one thing to actually make this legislation more passable, I would guess, if that was changed. I don't know that it's very passable at all, though, which was one of the things that was said earlier. But this is seen as an opportunity to get all sorts of things. I mean, the House Republicans are calling for capital gains cuts in this process. The mark-to-market is, the idea that Newt Gingrich is saying this is wrong, and this attack on Sarbanes-Oxley that's going ahead with this is surreal, because these are supposed to be the people that are market fundamentalists, and they're saying we can't use the market to price the assets of these banks. I don't know. It's through a looking glass, it seems to me. There's a question there somewhere. But Professor Gertz, I think you should, when you speak before the Academy for Limited Government and Capitalism, you should tell them they should turn it around and call it the Academy for Government and Limited Capitalism, don't you think?
Well, I think the world is complicated, and the one place I find it not an easy situation to deal with. There's no one who's more against the typical bailout than I am, of supporting a firm that's failing and so on. But there's a different world in terms of financial institutions. You do things you have to do, and you don't like it, but sometimes you do it. And so that's the situation, that we can't have a destabilizing kind of situation in the financial markets, and you have to do things that otherwise would not like to do. So it's a question of not what you want to do, it's what you have to do.
Quick follow-up?
You're presuming that it can be saved. I think that may be an assumption that's not warranted in the situation, and that maybe we need to have fresher ideas, period. And I don't think you're going to find any over at that academy. But what about this idea of mark-to-market? I mean, don't you think that that is something? A lot of the House Republicans are saying that it's a phony crisis, that because of this mark-to-market where you have to mark down the asset values that the banks are, but what are they going to? How are they going to establish the price of something? Are they just going to write down a value on a piece of paper? That seems to be what's actually been happening a lot.
Well, the problem is not that these assets are worthless; it's they're unpriced right now. There may be some very valuable things, but as Ann said, other banks don't know. So part of it is not necessarily just getting rid of the worthless things; it's being able to value the ones that have some worth. So that's part of the process. So it's not an easy situation. We have to make some compromises that would not be desirable in other circumstances. But you're coming down to the situation you want to punish the whole system and everyone to maintain this particular view, and I think it's not worth it.
And coming back to Paulson, I think one of the reasons he proposed the reverse auction is that auctions are ways to establish prices through a market. And the idea is that the government would be on the buying side of these things, so it would buy up these things and it would hold them for a while until markets stabilize, and then resell them at a better time. A previous caller mentioned Sweden. Sweden held on to financial instruments for a while, and things came back. And so the initial projections for the bailout in Sweden were much lower than they initially foresaw. And so just, again, to give you a comparison, there was a crisis in Sweden, but also Finland, their neighbor, in 1991. Sweden, their system worked pretty well in terms of their stabilization plan. It costs 3.6% of GDP to recapitalize the system, which is not incidental, of course. But in Finland, it was 12.8%. So these details matter a lot in terms of how much it's going to cost. And I think that's another reason why Paulson was saying, give me the freedom to, if changes need to be made, to make those changes. I think this idea of trying the reverse auction is something that was clearly his first option. But this mark-to-market, this is an accounting rule that the SEC now has the ability to suspend if it wants to. But there is this question of what is the price? And that was, I think, the thinking behind doing the reverse auction.
Yeah. The other problem is that if you get rid of market pricing, you can go back to the Japanese model where they hid assets and didn't price them properly for years, and that made the recovery much more difficult. So some kind of ad hoc measure like we're talking about may be the best way to go about it.
Yeah, and auctions get information out there. That's a big part of this crisis. Everybody knows that there are problems, but no one knows who's holding the toxic debt. Nobody knows what the appropriate price is, and that's part of what this plan is designed to do, to get it out there. And I agree with Fred completely. In Japan, there was too much, let's sweep it under the rug. And it took 10 years and a lot of GDP.
Very quickly, just to pick up on one of the points that Colin made, and I think it is true, as he said, that one of the things that apparently Republicans, I think, in the House were really talking about, including as part of this package, was a cut of capital gains tax, something that they've been wanting to have for a long time. And I guess when I heard that, my thought was, well, what exactly does that have to do with anything? Would that help the situation that we're in?
Well, I think that's a different question. It's not something that should be addressed as part of the package. And people different views about that, but I think that's sort of irrelevant in terms of the immediate problem. The caller did have an argument that I think could be advanced, and that is that if you're going to have these de facto guarantees, there probably is a rationale for more regulation in the future. Again, one reason for not having regulation is the markets are self-regulating if you have competition and so on, but to the extent that you have the implicit guarantees of the government, then there is a rationale for some regulation in these particular areas, not broadly but narrowly focused.
Let's talk with someone else. Line 3, Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I heard a commentator, I don't remember where, in the last few days, BBC or NPR, someplace like that. His remark was, I think I know what your answer to this will be, but his remark was that he thought that Wall Street and so forth were behaving along the lines of, give us this bailout or we'll kill ourselves. They're as if sort of like, you don't give me what I want, I'm going to hold my breath till I die or something like that. And to what extent do you think that might be the case? Because I think that's a suspicion that is harbored in the breast of many a fellow American. And if the government was to be laissez-faire and just say, well, you guys made this problem, you fix it yourselves, is it not possible for the parties involved to privately and amongst themselves sort this out amongst themselves if they wanted to? Thank you.
Well, I think the sort of case-by-case serial sort of dealing with these problems does leave itself open to the kind of problem you talked about. The one story that I think is fairly clear is that Bear Stearns back in March held out and sort of threatened, we're going to commit suicide and let the whole market devolve if you don't give us a better deal. And I think he ended up getting a better deal. So that's probably an argument for having a more systematic way of dealing with the problem as opposed to case by case, firm by firm, coming in and making some kind of arrangement, merging or being bought out or whatever it might be.
All right. We'll go on here. Let me just very quickly introduce our guests once again, Fred Gertz and Ann Villamo. They're both professors of economics here at University of Illinois. We're talking about the current economic crisis. We have about 15 minutes left in the show. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And up next, we'll talk with someone in Chicago on our line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Welcome back, Dave. Good to have you back. I'm a little late to the show, so I hope you'll pardon me if I bring up something that has been said before. But I have a little. Here's what I have the problem with: this $700 billion bailout. Didn't we do this for the savings loan in the 1980s? Spend $500 trillion bailing them out. And why aren't we hearing about accountability? I mean, the same people who made this problem are going to be there after this bailout goes through. Basically, all we're doing is buying a bunch of bad paper, bad loans, bad mortgages made by the same people. I think if this was a welfare thing, that you would hear people yammering all day about the undeserving poor and about how we have to watch this stuff. And what makes you think that 5 or 10 years down the road, if we don't have some kind of accountability, this won't happen again?
Well, to answer your question, yes, we did do this with the savings and loan. This was in 1988.
Wasn't that $500 trillion there?
Let's talk about it in terms of GDP. It was 3.7% of GDP. Yes, we did it. But remember, the 90s, we solved that problem. So, the previous caller was concerned about, can we solve this problem? And the answer is yes, we can. We've solved these problems before. Other countries have solved them. They're expensive. And, as Fred pointed out, we're certainly going to need changes in policy, more oversight, regulation, things of that nature. We fixed some problems and then some circumstances changed we have some different problems now that we need to address.
Yeah, it's too much to expect that we'll solve a problem now and we'll set up a kind of automatic mechanism that will keep us safe forever and ever in the future. If we can have a crisis every 20 years and deal with it successfully, that's not a bad record.
Well,
and said that crises are, in fact, reoccurring. And
mm-hmm. Except that here's what the problem is. I think if we don't fix it now, it's going to happen again 5, 10 years down the road. You're going to see another president coming up and saying, we need to allocate, because of inflation, $2 or 3 trillion to bail out someone else.
Well, let's think about what happened. There's been a tremendous amount of financial innovation, and some of that innovation has been very good. Some of it has been unchecked, and so now we need to get the processes in place to oversee and, in some cases, understand a lot of these instruments.
All right. Now, is there a criminal investigation going on, or is Congress going to hold hearings to find out who's responsible? This is a man-made economic problem.
Well, supposedly there was an investigation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and there could have been actual fraud in some circumstances. It's probably whether or not it's fraud or criminal is probably open question, but that's not the immediate concern now. The immediate concern is correct the problem. So I'm sure there'll be investigations. And if you look at the Enron collapse, all kinds of criminal things that came out of that. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. But that's sort of whether it's criminal or non-criminal negligence or whatever is sort of irrelevant right now. We have to deal with the problem.
Right. I mean, I think one of the messages is that this is a two-pronged solution. One is to deal with the immediate crisis phase, and the other is the long-term deliberative congressional hearings and potentially even criminal proceedings.
And there may well – I mean, Anne said there's a tremendous ability to innovate in the financial markets. It's not that we could have a new set of rules that solved our old problems, and firms can come up with new innovative kind of things that may 10, 20 years from now create other problems. So I don't think we can hope to solve our problems in perpetuity. If we can get another 2 decades, I'll be happy with that.
We have, again, I want to thank the caller. We have others. We have about 10 minutes. Next, we'll talk with someone in Bourbonnais. Line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I, too, did not come in at the beginning, so forgive me if this has already been asked. What are the details of this bailout plan?
I
don't know the details. I know.
Summarize what we're talking about.
Well, I think the immediate thing is to try to somehow deal with this. We call it toxic securities, and try to get them priced and get some stability back to the system. And it's probably better able than I to talk about the actual details. But I don't think most people really know that. And well, I'm not sure the Congress even knows that. It's more a matter that the intent's there, the resources are there, and then the Treasury and other organizations have to get it going in the next few weeks and few months.
Is there a way for us to find out how this thing is supposed to work?
Well, I mean, it's on the the old bill was on the website, but I doubt if you can read the bill and tell what actually is supposed to happen there. So
right.
You can read Financial, Wall Street Journal, and so on. We'll tell it in a general way. But
I've been looking in the Wall Street Journal. I haven't found it.
Yeah, the basic problem is that we need to recapitalize the system. There have been a number of proposals. The thing most talked about has been this idea of a reverse auction, because everybody agrees there's toxic debt. There are two problems. One is we're not sure who's holding it, and the second is – you know, even when we find it, we're not sure about the appropriate price. So the way to deal with this is either to have these reverse auctions where this debt would be auctioned off and the market would establish a price. The government would buy it, be patient enough until things improve and resell it, hopefully potentially at a profit. Warrants, some idea of that the government really has a share in some of these banks that it's recapitalizing. And the third option, which is not part of the existing legislation but people are talking about, is changing regulations like this SEC rule of mark-to-market, which is an accounting rule which tells you how you should value these assets at their market price. Some people say we should just suspend that.
Well, I think it's also very optimistic. I hope it's true, but it's very optimistic to think Congress will approve the bill on Wednesday, and it will go into motion, and we're suddenly back on the road to recovery. I suspect there'll be other crises that arise in the next 6 months or so, and they'll have to be dealt with in a ad hoc way because we don't know exactly what the crises are, where they came from, and so on. I never really had thought about bailing out an insurance company until a couple weeks ago, but there are things happening there that requires some ingenuity and some flexibility. I think we'd have to maintain that flexibility in the next year or so.
Okay. I do have another question.
Sure.
And I think it's Thursday that they're supposed to come back on it. Where does the $700 billion come from? Did it just...
I guess the government's willing to – it can be taxes or borrowing or whatever. It's there. And plus, the Federal Reserve has assets, but that's a different question. But
which pocket does it come out of? What gets sacrificed to come up with a $700 billion?
Well, it could be nothing. It could be I think Senator Obama talked about it may delay the progress of his health care funding, things of that sort. So it can come out of any place. It can come out of no place. It may be really large. It may not be nearly as large as we think. They may not use the full $700 billion, and maybe that's not enough. So I think that there's all kinds of possibilities. It's basically coming out of government activities, and some of that can be done by borrowing. Some of it can be done by cutting back programs. But I suspect it will be more borrowing than it will be programs.
Right. But, I mean, ultimately, taxpayers are behind this. There should be no illusion about that. The question is, what is it going to cost? So if we go back to the cleanup of the financial system in Sweden, you know, people made projections. So they said that they thought it was going to be, I think, about 5% of GDP. It came in at less than that. And that's the hope here. That basically here is this line of credit. We're going to be able to use it to stabilize the economy. The government will have these assets. When the economy stabilizes, some of these things that the government has bought may go up in value. And so hopefully it will not be as costly as the $700 billion. But no one knows that.
But also, it's compared to what? And compared to what is the damage it would do to the economy? So $700 billion might be a bargain if we're talking about several trillion dollars in terms of damage to the economy over the next 5 or 10 years.
Right, because, you know, what's at the root cause, the root of this problem? It's these bad mortgages. But if businesses start failing and they start defaulting on their loans, we're going to have an even bigger problem. We're going to have more defaulted loans, and we're going to have businesses that are not operating, laying off people, you know, can't pay their taxes, et cetera, because they have no jobs. So that's what this program is designed to do, to prevent this kind of downward spiral.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. I think that there is also this promise, this potential that we get that we, the taxpayers, get something back on our investment. That is, we're laying out this $700 billion. Maybe there's a question of what we get for that. It's not like we're getting nothing for that. But the hope is that if we're getting some kind of asset, that eventually we can turn that around and we're going to get something back. I mean, is it really reasonable to think that the government might actually make money eventually?
It happened in Sweden.
It did.
Yes.
And also, the point is, I think the politicians want to get the bill passed, or at least some of them do. And realism isn't necessarily the main thing. There's also a provision in the bill saying that if there's a bigger loss than expected, they'll come back and figure out some way to tax the financial community and recoup that money. Well, that's not very likely to happen. And, you know, 5, 10, 20 years from now, are we going to have a tax to get back a certain amount? And probably the answer is no. But the point is, it makes the bill more palatable and makes it more easily passed. But again, if you think back, did any of us – we all were worried, I think, in the problem with the savings and loan crisis, but it kind of receded away. No one ever declared victory. It wasn't mission accomplished. It was kind of receding and receding, and by the early 90s, it had gone away. And I think the hope is that something like that will happen in regard to this crisis.
Right. And the U.S. economy had a period of sustained growth after the savings and loan crisis. You know, so these comments about, you know, can we really fix this? Yes, we can. We've fixed it before.
Let's talk with someone in Urbana. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about the upside and downside to the government or the taxpayer of the so-called insurance. Rather than buying the mortgage, the government merely insures the mortgages.
Well, I think there have been – I'm not sure what you mean by insurance, whether it's explicit insurance or an implicit guarantee.
Of the government so vested in the purchase of these mortgages, but to merely insure them.
Well, insurance isn't a whole lot different. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were guaranteeing them, and they ended up holding the bag. An insurance company could end up holding the bag if it's done improperly.
If the insurance company is the United States, then they wind up holding a bag, and there's no upside.
Right. Well, Fannie, I mean, we're getting a little bit different area, but the original reason for these kind of quasi-government agencies was trying to promote housing ownership and things of that sort, and they made it easier for mortgages to...
No, I'm talking about the current bailout. There was a countervailing proposal to not bail out but bail out by insuring.
I guess I'm not familiar.
What? Not familiar? Well, it was a Republican plan.
Yeah, no, I read a little bit about that, but I think that, we're still stuck with this problem of people defaulting on their mortgages, and then there's a loss, and someone has to absorb that.
All right. Well, again, I hope the caller will forgive me if I go on here. In the time that remains, we want to try to get to at least a couple more callers. And next up, we'll talk with somebody in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Yes. Hi. Two things. I think a great revenue enhancer would be to charge a penny for every financial trade executed in the futures market, the equity markets, or the currency markets. Studies that have come out recently peg $200 billion a year of revenue. And also, you know, I do take issue with this notion that it's just the folks who couldn't pay their mortgage that are at the center of this. Actually, what it is, the problem is the financial instruments and the exotic instruments derived of those mortgages that were levered to the hilt, sometimes at 100-to-1, in firms that were undercapitalized. And I wish people would just clarify that. Thank you.
Okay. No. That's absolutely true that there was very high leverage. But I think, you know, as Fred and I have both pointed out, those kinds of regulatory changes are the kinds of things that are going to have to occur in the future.
Well, I suppose a lot of people, the question they're asking is why didn't we do it a long time ago? Is this ultimately a failure of regulation?
I think it's a failure of policy, not necessarily regulation. We talked about several different failures. One was being too aggressive in monetary policy after the 2001 recession and keeping the interest rates too low. Alternative, if you're going to do that, you could try to keep the interest rates low, but then regulate to maintain some stability in the housing market, and they didn't do that. So they're all and there are issues about the underlying quality of the debt that was being securitized in terms of the housing market. So a lot of things could be done differently had we the chance to do it over again.
All right, we'll try to get at least one more caller, and that would be Danville, line two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was just listening, and the lady said that, you know, she didn't really place the burden of this on the taxpayers. And basically, one of the big problems with our country, I feel, is us taxpayers are pretending like this isn't coming out of our pocket. And it's definitely coming out of our pocket. And we're not owning that. And that's one of the reasons why we're in this mess, I think, is because it takes us so long to get really angry about what our government's doing. Another thing is, you can't believe anything that any of these guys are saying. And so when they do tell you the truth, you don't believe them because they've lied to us so much. We don't want to believe, you know, you can't believe any of these people. And then everybody's got their daggone fingers in it. Somebody was saying yesterday on the news that the financial people had the power right now, and they're basically stealing us blind. The immorality and the greed in our country with people building many thousand square foot houses that they don't really need and everything, it just is, to me, all part of the problem.
I appreciate the comment. We can give you, each about 30 seconds if you want to comment any way that you like.
Well, my takeaway on that comment is, it's kind of Peter and the Wolf. This, I understand what he's saying, that people feel that they've lost trust in what policymakers are saying. But this is real, and it demands a real policy response.
Yeah, I would say that we're dealing in a different and somewhat unusual, and I hope rare, situation, and it does require overt, direct kind of government intervention. That's usually not the solution to most economic problems, but there are different rules, and the financial area is a different world, and maintaining stability there is really important, and this is something that has to be done, and how it happened or how it might not happen again really is important, but not important in the short run. Action has to be taken, and I think that it's needed, and I guess I'm somewhat optimistic that the Congress actually will come up with something in the next few days.
All right. Well, there we'll have to leave it. I'm sure we'll come back to much of this on future shows, but for the moment, we close out with our thanks to U of I economist Fred Gertz and Anne Villamil. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Support for the broadcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, 6th and University in Champaign, for over 15 years providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. We'll take a break as we usually do. We'll have some news from NPR. Before that, an update on the market, so please stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Soybeans are being pressured by today's release from NASS of a larger-than-expected U.S. September 1 soy stocks figure, as well as an upward revision of its 2007 soybean production estimate. Stronger dollar is also weighing on the market to the downside today. But some early strength, although crude oil has been trading a little bit weaker at the moment, has offered some support to the market. Remember, we're in expanded trading limits today. Soybeans can trade as much as $1.05. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. We'll begin in the soybean pit, where November is now at 10.50, down 44. January, 10.62, down 48.5. March, 10.85, down 39.25. May, 10.99, down 38. October soybean meal at 2.81 is down $14.